Radio EcoShock.
As African Americans die in extraordinary numbers during the coronavirus pandemic, maybe we can find food at the root of this tragedy. Complications from food-related illnesses like diabetes, heart conditions, and obesity are already, unfortunately, a pandemic inside the Black community, and we want to know why. Malik Yakini is working to change that deadly system. He's bringing control and empowerment back to the community in Detroit. Formerly a school principal, Malik helps run D-Town Farm. He is co-founder and executive director of the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network, and he's a member of the National Food Justice Alliance. Malik Yakini, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
In any other time, I would just sit back and listen to you about food and the work to be done, but we are in a pandemic, and our listeners are thinking about that. Did you think my linking food to the high percentage of Black deaths in cities from Detroit through Chicago to Philly, is that a fair one?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely fair, and actually it's refreshing because you're the first journalist who I've heard make that link. And so, you know, food interacts with every other aspect of our lives, and certainly the kind of health disparities that we see in Black communities throughout the United States are caused, at least in part, by the lack of access to high-quality, nutrient-dense foods. And so those foods are kind of the building block of human health and the building block of strong immune systems. So what we see in many urban communities, and sometimes in the U.S., urban is kind of a code word for Black because many cities are either predominantly Black or have very large Black and brown populations. So what we see often, though, is that, number one, many grocery stores have abandoned kind of the inner cities, the core cities, as we saw white flight in the 1960s and 70s, and we saw suburban subdivisions being built outside of cities. Many times grocery stores would kind of follow that population density and would locate in those suburban subdivisions, and we see fewer and fewer of those full-service grocery stores in places like Detroit. And in fact, specifically in Detroit, when I was growing up in the 1960s, there were at least six or seven national chain grocery stores in Detroit, and each one of them had multiple locations throughout the city. So almost wherever you were within the city, you were within walking distance of a full-service, nationally-owned grocery store. As of 2007, when Farmer Jack closed its last stores in Detroit, there were no more national chain groceries in Detroit. Now, to be fair, there's a series of maybe 70 or 80 independently-owned grocery stores in Detroit, but far too often the quality of the food sold in those stores is lacking when compared to the quality of food sold in the suburbs. Far too often the hygienic conditions in those stores leave a lot to be desired, and far too often people working in the stores are disrespectful to the community members who are residents of the community in which they operate. And so what we found in places like Detroit is that often people, particularly people that don't have access to automobiles, that's another factor I want to throw into this discussion, transportation is related to food security because you have to be able to get to where the food is. So in a place like Detroit, where about 40% of the residents don't own an automobile, and also in Detroit, we don't have a robust public transportation system, what often happens is that people go to places which are in walking distance of their homes. And far too often, those locations are gas stations and what we call in Detroit party stores, or what they call on the East Coast bodegas, places that sell potato chips, cigarettes, lottery tickets, soda pop, and the like. So many people are getting lots of their calories from either these party stores or from gas stations. And those calories are what we call empty calories. They're not really high in nutrients, and they don't help to build the kind of strong immunodefense that we need to ward off not only the COVID-19, the coronavirus that's causing COVID-19, but also to ward off other illnesses that impact Black communities.
And I suspect some listeners will say, well, why don't African Americans make better food choices? But you've just answered that question. I think Michelle Obama was kind of a leader in her quiet way. She planted a vegetable garden at the White House, which Trump ripped out, of course. And she was instrumental in getting Walmart to start selling affordable fresh produce. And that was a bit of a help. Talk to us about your roots here, the D-Town Farm?
Well, you know, you mentioned former First Lady Michelle Obama, and interestingly, I was invited to the White House when she made this announcement about Walmart and Walgreens selling food. And I have to tell you, I was really a bit disappointed because on a certain level, you know, having Walmart or Walgreens sell food to urban areas provides greater access to food. The other problem, though, is that it undermines community self-determination. And so, you know, trying to think about how we build local strong food systems from the ground up, which are really controlled by community members as opposed to being controlled by multinational corporations, would be the preferred route. And that's the type of work that we're doing in Detroit and is happening throughout the United States, where you have churches, community organizations that are building farms, that are creating food policy councils, that are creating food co-ops, and thinking about how we localize the creation of food systems so that the dollars spent within that food system stay in the communities that are spending those dollars, and we create community empowerment, as opposed to only thinking about access in the sense that you have a store that you can go in and get food and not thinking about what happens to the profits on the other end. But certainly, you know, Michelle Obama speaking up about food insecurity was very helpful, and it helped the gardening movement, and it helped people begin to think more critically about the need for food justice. But specifically in Detroit, the organization that I lead is called the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network, and we've done several things in the 14 years, I'm sorry, that we've been in existence since 2006. The first thing is that we operate Detroit's largest farm, which you mentioned earlier, which is D-Town Farm, which is a 7-acre farm at which we grow somewhere between 35 and 40 different fruits, vegetables, and herbs each year that we sell to individuals, primarily at farmers markets and also to farm stands at our farm, and we sell to a few wholesale customers as well. And so what we're doing is we're producing kind of hyper-local produce that is very high in nutrients, and also we're reducing the carbon footprint that it takes to transport food. So in the United States, food is transported an average of 1,500 miles from the point that the food is produced to where it's consumed, and most of that food is transported via truck. Those trucks run on diesel fuel, which spew a great deal of carbon into the atmosphere and are a contributor to global warming. And so by growing food closer to where we have population density and having to transport it fewer miles, we're actually contributing to a healthier ecosystem. So that's one of the things that that we do, the farm. We also train a cohort of farmers each year through formal internship programs and through volunteer opportunities at our farm. We also at our farm model rainwater retention. So we have a pond that we put in that can collect about 50,000 gallons of rainwater, which we use as a secondary source for watering our crops. We're also connected to the municipal water system. We do large-scale composting. We do beekeeping. We have a children's area and have public events. We do lots and lots of tours. And really what we're trying to do is not only grow more hyper-local nutrient-dense produce, but we're also trying to help challenge people's thinking about what a more localized, fair, and just food system might look like. So in addition to the farm, we also have a youth program called the Food Warriors Youth Development Program that functions at a school on the east side of Detroit and a church on the west side of Detroit. And in both of those locations, we have children build raised bed gardens. We show them how to maintain those gardens, how to harvest the foods, how to prepare them in healthy ways, and we train them to be food justice advocates in their own community. A big project that we're working on now is called the Detroit Food Commons. We're building a new building on Detroit's main street. We haven't begun construction yet, let me be clear. We will be building a new building on Detroit's main street, a 34,000-square-foot, two-story building, the first floor of which will be occupied by the Detroit People's Food Co-op, a cooperatively owned grocery store, which will specialize in foods that are higher quality. We're kind of selling two types of food. We're selling what in the industry is called natural and organic food, and then we're also selling what we're calling clean conventional food. And then the last thing I'll say is that we also, near the beginnings of our organization in 2006, spoke to the Detroit City Council, and we were critical of the city for not having a comprehensive food policy. And so we were appointed to head a task force, which then wrote the City of Detroit's food security policy. And one of the most important aspects of that policy is that it called for the creation of the Detroit Food Policy Council, which we also stewarded into existence and chaired for its first 2 years. That organization continues to exist independently of our organization now. It has its own board, its own office, its own funding sources, but it continues to serve as an advisory body to the city government.
So African Americans have a huge, long culture of farming, but maybe that was seen as a kind of poverty of the sharecropping, something that a younger generation wanted to get away from towards a freedom in the cities as they saw it. Now it almost sounds like we need to reverse that and go back.
Yeah, well, we have a global problem. Across the planet, farming is not really seen as honorable work, and urban life is seen as somehow hipper and cooler and more sophisticated than rural life. So throughout the planet, you have people leaving rural areas, coming to the cities. So that's a global phenomenon. But people of African descent in the Western Hemisphere have a particular challenge. As you noted, part of that challenge is the history of sharecropping, but even the more egregious system of enslavement that people of African descent were subjected to for 200 years or so in both the United States and also in parts of the Caribbean and parts of Central and South America. And so the tremendous trauma associated with both enslavement and sharecropping has many black people kind of hesitant to get into urban agriculture, to get into agriculture at all. So part of the work of our organization is really to reshift our thinking, to reframe agriculture from the kind of framework many of our people see it, you know, within the context of enslavement and sharecropping, to reframe it as an act of self-determination, a way that communities can pull themselves up and create health and vibrancy for themselves.
As we speak, seed stores have sold out. I mean, Johnny Seeds said, well, we don't have any more seeds for you, and baby chicks are hard to get. Millions of Americans are suddenly out of work and out of money, and they're wondering how to feed themselves. Maybe this is the moment, Malik Yakini, the moment for food change.
Yeah, I think we have a tremendous opportunity, which is embedded in this terrible crisis that we're all facing. So, you know, one of the things that happens is that when you slow down, and the whole society is slowed down now with many people working at home, it gives you the chance to be more introspective and more critical in your thought. And so I'm hoping that we have a shift that occurs, not just in terms of food, but in terms of thinking about the relationship of human beings to each other, thinking about the relationship of human beings to the earth, as well as thinking about our relationship to food. So I can tell you for sure that I've had more people call me in the last 3 weeks asking about starting gardens than I have in the last 10 years. So seeing on the media grocery store shelves bare, I think, shocked a lot of people into reality, and it helped us to see the fragility in the industrial food system that provides a great deal of our food, that there's all kind of possible ways that that system can break down, and one of the ways that can impact it is, of course, disease, but there's all kinds of other ways that we can have potential breakdowns in that system. Because at this point, it's a global system. And so these huge global systems are going to break down in time. It's not a question of if they'll break down. It's a question of when. And so this has shocked a lot of people into reality. So people are much more interested now in both self-reliance in terms of food production. People are interested in cooperative ventures now. And many people are rethinking our relationship to the earth. You know, part of the problem with this whole pandemic has to do with how human beings view our relationship with the earth. The great Indian farmer and thought leader Vandana Shiva wrote an article the other day about the virus, food, and humanity. And one of the things that she pointed out is that many religious traditions have this idea of human beings having dominion over the earth or being here to dominate the earth and the other animals and plants who co-inhabit the planet with us. And so she is suggesting that one of the reasons that we're seeing these viruses, which have been transferred from wild animals to human beings, has to do with the encroachment of human beings on these formerly wild areas. And that is all rooted in this idea that we were put here to have dominance over the earth. And so I'm hoping that not only do we have a shift in terms of people gravitating more towards gardening and farming, but that we have a shift in terms of rethinking our relationship to the earth, and not seeing the earth as simply something that we extract from, but seeing the earth as kind of our divine mother, which is the case in many indigenous traditions, which we have to respect and we have the responsibility of being the stewards and caretakers of.
Now, on the nightly news, I hear about hot spots in America, and they talk about New York, and they talk about Louisiana, and they mention Chicago, and sort of as an afterthought, they throw in Detroit. But I can't actually really find out, except by reading Detroit newspapers, what's happening in Detroit. What are you seeing from your viewpoint?
Detroit is being hit very hard by the COVID-19 pandemic. I know several people who have been diagnosed as positive. I know a few people who have died. On Facebook every day, there's pretty much a continuous kind of listing of relatives of people that I know personally who have died. And so at this point, there have been hundreds of people in the city of Detroit who have died, something like 1,400 people in the state of Michigan. Interestingly, though, out of those 1,400 people in the state of Michigan, 42% of the people who have died have been African American, while we form just 14% of the population of the state of Michigan. So we're dying at three times the rate that you would expect to see represented in those statistics. In Chicago, black people are about a third of the population, but represent about 70% of the deaths. We're seeing similar statistics out of New Orleans, as you mentioned, and out of Milwaukee, and now out of St. Louis. And so the reality is that race impacts everything in American life. Racism is a constant factor that black people have to deal with. And it's not just a question of, you know, the kind of overt discrimination that we might sometimes face, but it's a question of the daily microaggressions that create stress. And we know that one of the things that breaks down the immune system is stress. And so racism creates stress, and that's one of the factors, in addition to food, that is causing a higher death rate among African Americans. Also, poverty is a factor. Now, clearly not all black people are in poverty, and not all black people who are dying of COVID-19 are in poverty. But the vast majority of African Americans are either at or below the poverty line. And so typically, when you don't have adequate income, you don't have adequate health care, it affects your food choices. You often have to work riskier jobs. We're seeing in Detroit that, you know, because as I mentioned earlier, 40% of the population doesn't have automobiles, that those folks, if they still have to go to work, have to ride public transportation, which then puts them more in harm's way. You know, any job that exposes you more to the general public is going to put you more in harm's way. And then finally, I saw something yesterday that also suggests that environmental factors may be playing a role in the rates of COVID-19 that we're seeing in places like Detroit, that air pollution and its impact on the respiratory system can make a person more susceptible to being diagnosed with COVID-19.
Absolutely. We've had experts on this show talking about the hidden effects of air pollution and long-term effects on the people's health. And I could go way back to 2007 Radio EcoShock, where we talked with a scientist who studied in Harlem and the actual air that people were breathing there, and it was poisonous. And there's just so many problems here that need to be unwound, but I have to believe that good food is a good place to start and a good place to get local community developing for itself. What else would you like to tell our listeners as we wrap up here, Malik?
Well, you know, the thing about the food movement is it impacts everyone. You know, when we try to build movements for justice, oftentimes we have various divisions because people have different ideologies, different religions, different views on gender. All these things are separated. But the thing about food is it's a great uniter. It's a common denominator. And so, you know, we have a tremendous opportunity now to think about justice in general, but also to think about how we create a more just food system so that everyone has equal access to high-quality food, because clearly this impacts the health of individuals, the health of communities, and the health of the nation as a whole. And so everyone, you know, when you take a bite of food, in a sense, you're making a political act. And so we want people to think more critically about food and how they can use their food dollars and their food choices and also their voices and their activism to shape a more just, sustainable, and resilient food system.
We have been speaking with Malik Yakini from the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network, and check out foodfirst.org. I'll put links to all this in my own show blog, ecoshock.org. Malik, thank you for helping us, and let's keep in touch. We do have common interests.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.